offices around the metro area later this morning. And in that case, we will bring you the latest results as soon as they are available. In Boulder, ballot measure 2L, which is pertaining to the municipalisation effort, it's too close to call at this point. Just 117 votes between those in favour of the measure and those against it. Those against it actually leading by just about 117 votes. But we will have more results being released later this morning. So do stay tuned here at KGNU. Coming up at 9 o'clock, a discussion with one of the plaintiffs in a case that is against the state of Colorado on behalf of the Colorado River. We will speak with one of the people involved in that case, which really centres on the rights of nature. That's coming up at 9 o'clock. Before that, though, Joe Yuhas is in for good old CU right after commentary from Jim Hightower.
Isn't it funny that right-wing politicians across the country piously rant against giving a few bucks worth of jobless benefits to the needy, then turn around and shove billions of our tax dollars into corporate welfare for the greedy? You're right, it's not funny. But here we go again. We're presently witnessing the most disgusting spectacle yet of the political corporate cabal extracting money from the people's wallets to enrich themselves. Amazon.com, the $136 billion a year internet colossus, has haughtily initiated a sleazy, self-serving public bidding war over where it will locate its new corporate headquarters. The city and state that offer the most bribe money to this private enterprise will be the winner. Uber-rich Amazon doesn't need and certainly doesn't deserve any public handout. But officials in 238 cities have prostrated themselves in front of this Amazonian welfare queen in embarrassing bids to win her nod. Amazon's arrogant executives even sent out a list of basic benefits they expect every applicant to deliver, including, quote, a business-friendly environment and tax structure, free land, a subsidy to reduce its operational costs, tax breaks, relocation grants for executives and workforce, reduced utility bills, and, oh yeah, also give us first-rate schools and an educated labor pool. As one analyst of Amazon's bribery scheme noted, these incentives aren't free. There's no fairy godmother paying for them. The typical result of corporate giveaways is that they cost the public more than we get back. By demanding such corporate spoils, Amazon brands itself as a common thief, not only taking our money, but also stealing our trust in the fairness of the system and widening inequality in our society. This is Jim Hightower saying, to help stop this corruption, go to goodjobsfirst.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Well, when you hear the stirring sounds of the alma mater, then you know it is time for good old CU and time for Joseph Yuhas, your host, on this once-a-month radio program where we talk about the University of Colorado in particular and the higher education scene, let's put it that way, in general. Very fortunate to have live on the telephone my guest, Bob Flanagan. Bob, are you there?
I am here, Professor Yuhas.
Are you here or are you there? I'm not exactly sure.
Well, I think I'm there, and it's nice to be back on good old CU. It's been a while.
Well, could you just briefly introduce yourself and then give some kind of contact information, and we go on from there?
Sure. I am an associate professor at the University of Colorado Denver. I'm an architect, and I teach in the College of Architecture and Planning. And my past life, from 2011 to 2013, I was chair of the Denver Faculty Assembly. And so I moved from the kind of macro, I guess, to the micro. And I'm sitting in my office now, and I'll be teaching class in about an hour from now.
Teaching in quotation marks or without quotation marks?
Well, Professor, knowing you, I must put that in quotation marks because the educational so-called teaching methodology certainly has changed quite dramatically over my time here, and especially over the last, I would say, six years or so has been quite a dramatic change.
Well, that gets us right on the topic, doesn't it? But before that, briefly, your contact information.
I can be just, my office number is 320FF, University of Colorado at Denver. And anybody that wants to give a call or stop by can simply, you know, call the front desk and they'll send your call right on through to me.
Great. Email address?
Robert.Flanagan@ucdenver.edu.
So in the meantime, let's just simply say that you're welcome to join this conversation, that is to say our listeners, at 303-442-4242 or on the 800 number, which exists somewhere, but I don't see it right now. Anyway, 303-442-4242 will get you on the conversation with me and Professor Flanagan. So you said teaching in quotation marks because whatever it is, it's changing under our feet. Can you give us a sense of where you feel shifting sands or how you feel shifting sands or something like that?
Well, I think some of this is kind of, you know, of course it's going to be focused on what I do, but in general, the there was a lot of this talk about flipped classrooms where people were going to learn, I guess you'd say technical and kind of book learning outside of the classroom, and then they would walk into the classroom and kind of exchange ideas or have other some other kind of you know, learning experience. And before I say what I do, I happen to I've been working on what I'm doing right now for the last 6 or 7 years. But I came across this article with this Harvard professor last year who was talking about how he told his students that they didn't need to come to class. And then he, in the next year, said, oh, no, you know, you must come to the lecture because I've found that students are missing something when they are not in the lecture environment. And then it was somewhat mysterious, and this was a pretty well-publicized study. And the basic idea was, is what was missing wasn't really clear. So they went out and started interviewing people around the country, you know, for what was missing. But from my point of view, I never really kind of got into changing my coursework based on what other people were doing or saying. It had to do with need. And in Denver, we have this thing called Canvas. And it sounds fairly innocuous, but Canvas is an amazing kind of tool. It centralizes the way that we work, the way we distribute information, the way that students provide information back to us, and basically organize our lives. So in my classroom, basically what I do is I have modules that are an hour and 15 minutes long twice a week. And for every class, I have a recorded video that usually contains, I guess, what you'd call the kind of flip part of the classroom that has technical information that summarizes the hour and 15 minutes that involve this technical information. And in the classroom, we attempt to have a discussion about or kind of implement those things that are in the tutorials, essentially about technical issues with computer-aided design, well, now building information technology, and designing and building architecture.
Well, for whatever reason, what you just said, which is more than interesting to me, I am going to come up with a completely random association. Ha ha. This morning I was looking at the news, which I do by looking on my computer, and there was a face of Mao Zedong, supposedly in Beijing, with an American flag waving in front of his face. And the context was President Trump physically, supposedly, being in Beijing, China, physically, supposedly, having a conversation with Mr. Xi and others. So he traveled an enormous distance to be there as a person and talking to a person rather than doing it by Skype or whatever else, or by using a recording. So what you say raises the question of, in the midst of this technological thunderstorm, rainstorm, blizzard that we are living in, what is the role of the live human being and live conversation that fits into that matrix, if anything at all? I am assuming that neither Mr. Xi nor Mr. Trump have decided to have an in-person meeting just as a nostalgic gesture, but maybe that's what it is. So, you know, what is the role of the live faculty member in the classroom? To me, that's the issue that you raised in your first comment. Any thoughts?
Before you go on too far on that, I do have a few thoughts on that. And that's that technical information, and I'll start with the political side first, is the reason that Trump is visiting these Asian countries and talking with their leaders is they somehow or other can't really believe their ears or their eyes, what they're seeing in the news. Trump is an enigma, and they certainly can't cross a cultural boundary to figure that out. And when he takes ownership of his ideas, I think they can read into that through body language, through the things he says, through his stream of consciousness, how his conversations take place. And if I could make that similar leap into another realm, I would say that the big thing here about the classroom, what is happening in the classroom now, and what happened is happening with technology, is that the technology really is kind of like a speeded up book learning in a lot of ways, but the critical component is to take ownership of your ideas. So I can teach five different technological issues about buildings, like I'm talking about structure today, facades, what exiting is in a building, how to provide safety, health and welfare. But those individual issues you can test, place on a test and get, A, B, C, D, you can get true and false, but you really don't synthesize what the learning is. And that learning needs to be, the student really needs to take ownership of that idea and communicate that ownership to the professor, and the professor in turn back to the student, so that there's this dialogue of learning and engagement.
You're listening to Good Old CU here on KGNU Radio, Boulder, Denver, and the Ionosphere. And this is Joe Yuhas, your host, live on the telephone. Professor Robert Flanagan, University of Colorado at Denver. We're discussing relationship between faculty and students, I suppose, in the narrowest sense, in the present moment. You are welcome to join this conversation by dialing 303-444-4242. Pardon me. Well, the word ownership takes us, in fact, I suppose, to that question that you raised about, with all these incredible media world that we live in as citizens, as faculty members, as students, etc., etc., the President of the United States remains an enigma. Now, that is the name of a method of communication that the Germans had, that the British usefully cracked. Let's not go there. In other words, something we cannot quite decode. How is that possible in the 21st century to remain an enigma? The undecodable in cipher.
Well, you know, that's really a tough one.
Well, who said I wasn't tough? Did I say I wasn't tough?
Yeah, well, of course, you know, the problem for us is trying to decode what it is that is effective in education, because we are at odds with two things that are confronting us. One is we have to transfer information more effectively, and information that's coming at us and evolving at a faster rate, and we have to, and then, of course, we have to communicate it more effectively. And if I could just jump back into one thing that's happening at CU that I think is significant. Regent Steve Ludwig is working on this. He calls it a moonshot, which is it's a two-part program. It's a, I guess you'd say online. It is online, and it is not in the classroom. And it also has a maximum cost of $15,000 for aimed specifically, I guess, at students in rural areas and people that are on limited budgets that cannot be on campus. And I think usually I would kind of just kind of bypass this kind of information and say, well, this is, you know, like pie in the sky stuff. But I've learned that Regent Ludwig was very kind of instrumental in moving things like this forward with his Transfer of Promise initiative back when I was chair of the Faculty Assembly. This back in the 2011 to 2013. And it was one of the best programs that's ever been instituted here in order to use community colleges as kind of feeders into the CU system, where the cost is not drowning the students, and they get a very good education that is coordinated with what we're doing here at on the Denver campus. So I've found that to be very encouraging that Steve Ludwig is working at this. And my one comment on that, again, is I think that the three-year thing is probably obtainable in some aspects, and I think the part to be worked out is the part about how students take ownership of the idea. And my personal preference would be either in nonprofits or military or something else that provides some kind of overlay with the online learning. It doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, on campus.
I am very, very taken with this association that you made and the idea of making higher education accessible to people of fairly limited means. I guess my question is it theoretically, practically, pragmatically possible, or should it be, to involve live interaction into a concept like that? Or is it something that is correctly, in your view, independent of live interaction? That is getting us back to kind of like the role of body language, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in human communication and interaction.
Well, I think that, of course, is the question. I guess my position on that is theoretically this is possible, and I believe that the regents, led by Ludwig, I think, on this one, and then the faculty, through the Faculty Assembly, Faculty Council and Faculty Assemblies, we'll probably try to examine this. And I also think that this is looking into the future. I think that, you know, we're not just stuck here in 2017. We're looking forward to, like, things that are likely to evolve in 2025 that are far different than anything we're looking at today. And I think this is one option that is really worth looking into, because we have real structural problems in our economy with employment, about the expense of getting an education, and the possibility of getting a job, and jobs that are disappearing, and jobs that are evolving. You know what I mean? I just think it's a good idea.
I certainly know what you mean, and as much as anything else, I'm going to make these two remarks that are in my head for the sake of argument, quote unquote. So for the sake of argument, a program that is entirely online, wouldn't it be better not to localize it to Denver, but essentially to develop one for any place that can be accessed for more or less nothing to convey that kind of information which is best conveyed, so to say, as you put it earlier, kind of like right. Textbook learning?
Well, this already exists today. I mean, we've seen this for the last 5 years or so. We have these free courses offered at Harvard or, you know, the big Yale or wherever it is. Some of these big schools have these. I can't even remember the catchword they have for them today. But I don't think that they're really...
Massive online courses, MOCs.
Okay. And I don't think that was very successful at all in providing something equivalent to or even nearly equivalent to what you would consider a degree program would be. I think that your instinct that this has to have human interaction is absolutely critical. I also think that the idea of using nonprofits or a non-traditional non-corporate kind of work environments is probably going to allow students to take ownership of their ideas. So if a student was working in a nonprofit, say one firm I like is Colorado Coalition for the Homeless, if they were working there and they were working as an intern and they were learning about how to put together grants and proposals and how that works with the homeless, and they can write a kind of theoretical or thesis paper about this thing, even as an undergraduate, that would be a very good education. So there's some kind of, it's not a completely new model, but I think it's one that will change with tools like Canvas, where there's a possibility of real interaction in the classroom and with the professor. I really think that's possible.
I'm going to hold my second thought because we do have a caller. Valerie, welcome to KGNU. You are on live with Bob Flanagan.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. So I am very interested in what you were talking about with the online learning, and it sounds like you're describing a mixture in your classroom of online tutorials and also human contact. So I actually have a master's in architecture, and I've been quietly working part-time up here raising a family. I also play Celtic harp, and interestingly enough, on the Celtic harp, you know, there's not that many of us floating around the world. And there's a harper in San Francisco who does virtual harp summits, and she puts together online tutorials with live Facebook time. But she brings together musicians from all over the world. And I also have a friend in Australia with whom we Skype and swap music. And it's a really exciting thing to me that I can use my computer as this window to a huge world. But then at the same time, it's really critical that we have human-to-human interaction and maybe finding the right balance of that. I think especially when I think about music and architecture, these things, we have to touch each other, like right in physical time also, and have a connection there.
Great comments, Valerie. I'm going to have to cut you short because I am the slave of a clock. But thank you so much. And Bob, your response.
Point about the idea of specialties. Today, there are increasing specialties in architecture as well that have to do with issues like, for instance, about especially about materiality, new thoughts on health and safety. And the audience in Denver would be too small to have a class or even a, you might have a symposium or something once in a while, but really the only way to reach the specialty audience is online. And I love your association between the harp and music and architecture because I think it's
well, with a name like Flanagan, you should be able to... anybody can decode that you paid Valerie $20 to make that phone call.
So I do appreciate that.
We've got a little bit less than a minute remaining, and we've opened, I think, numerous doors, and I'm really very, very grateful to you. Any final thoughts in half a minute or so?
Okay. I am really... There's an article that everybody should read that Stephen Hawking is pretty well represented on the web that has to do with artificial intelligence and especially the displacement. He doesn't talk about displacement of workers, but I do, in that as things change over the next 10 years, as all the truck drivers are kind of systematic, not all, but as truck drivers and people that do kind of labor that is based on intelligence, that will be replaced by automated trucking, automated trains, automated transportation, as just as an example. We really need to look at the structural unemployment that is not represented in the low unemployment.
We got to finish up, Bob. Thank you so very, very much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Professor.
This is Joseph Juha signing off and again thanking my guest, Robert Flanagan, architecture professor at the University of Colorado, Denver, who can be reached at robert.flanagan@ucdenver.edu.
Support comes from Boulder Country Day School, a private preschool through IB Middle School located in Gun Barrel, Colorado, where children innovate, create, grow, and thrive. They will be holding their open house on Wednesday, November 8th. More information can be found at bouldercountryday.org.
This is Community Radio KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. It's just past 9 o'clock. We'll continue to bring you updates on the local elections as more results are being released and the next round of results should be released later this morning, so we'll keep you updated. In the meantime, you can find out that information online at kgnu.org. Just click on Election 2017 right there at the top of the page. Coming up at 9:30, we'll have the latest music in the morning, Sound Alternative. But before that, a discussion on the rights of nature. That's at the centre of a lawsuit in the Colorado courts right now. Plaintiffs have filed on behalf of the Colorado River against the state of Colorado. We'll speak with one of the people involved in that lawsuit in just a moment. This is Community Radio, KGNU. September, a lawsuit was filed in a Denver court on behalf of the Colorado River. The defendant in the suit is the state of Colorado. The lawsuit is being filed on behalf of the Colorado River by a group of friends. It's a legal definition, five next friends. And one of those people involved is Will Falk, who's an attorney and a writer. And he joins us now by phone. Good morning, Will. We'll try that again. Will, are you with us? Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's good to have you with us. And actually, you are right now on a journey down the river. Is that correct? Where are you talking to us from this morning?
I am talking to you from Moab, Utah. I spent the last few nights down in Canyonlands National Park. I'm traveling with a photographer named Michelle McCarran from Jackson, Wyoming. But we've been on the road for close to 15 or 16 days now, traveling along the river and trying to get to know her better.
Well, just in terms of this particular lawsuit, the Colorado River versus the state of Colorado, what is your legal role in this lawsuit?
My role is, as you explained, I'm listed as one of the next friends, and a next friend is a legal concept that makes me a fiduciary or a guardian of the river. This is a concept that is often used in cases involving people with mental disabilities or other things that would make them not legally competent. So a next friend is someone that the court recognizes as representing the interests of someone that is not legally competent in court. My function quite simply is as a fiduciary of the river.
Well, we have spoken with the attorney who's actually representing you and the other folks in this particular case, Jason Flores-Williams, several times about this case. But I think this is the first time we have one of the next friends, people involved in the case, on the air. So, Will, why have you gotten involved in this? And why does the Colorado River need to sue the state of Colorado for rights?
I've gotten involved in this because the Colorado River is one of the most endangered rivers in the world. It's quite well known by now that the Colorado River rarely flows to the sea. It's horribly overdrawn and, in fact, over-allocated. And I see the rights of nature as a mechanism for the American legal system to join the 21st century, quite frankly. I see it as an opportunity for the American legal system to recognize the environmental destruction that we're seeing daily and help the legal system contemplate that with responses that can address that environmental destruction.
Well, the state of Colorado, which is the plaintiff, or excuse me, the defendant in this lawsuit, is the headwater state because that river, named after the state, or the state named after the river, we have this integral connection. However, there are seven other states who draw water off the river. And then, of course, Mexico is involved. And they're all involved in this very complex legal framework called the Colorado Compact, which was signed in 1922. So given that complexity and the interconnectedness of the Colorado River with not just the state of Colorado, but all of the other basin states, how will this legally function, given that there are so many other states involved in depleting the river?
Well, if the federal courts begin to recognize rights of nature for ecosystems like the Colorado River, it will give communities all along the river, from the headwaters all the way down to where it enters Mexico, it will give them an avenue for addressing local problems with the river. It'll give members in whole states a tool to address the problems along the river where they live. The way it will function is it will give people who care about the river a way to step into the courts and say, "Hey, the way we're treating the river right now is not working. The river itself has subjective value. And we need to put that subjective value against a corporation's right to overdraw it or exploit it. So yeah, it will give all these local communities a new tool to address the problems where they are.
Well, you're also, in addition to being, I suppose, an environmental activist and a writer, and we'll talk about the latest article that you've just written in the San Diego Free Press about this particular issue, but you're also an attorney. So in terms of US law, has this ever been used before, the rights of nature, for a natural entity to have rights in and of itself to exist? Given that, particularly, it seems in the Western US, we have this attitude around extraction of natural resources. So how does this work legally? Has there been a legal precedent set before on this?
No, this is the first case in federal court where a major ecosystem like the Colorado River has requested rights of nature and a recognition of the ecosystem's personhood. There have been in several municipalities and counties around the country, similar rights of nature lawsuits. But this is the first one in federal court, and it's the first one of the magnitude of an entire ecosystem. In terms of precedent, there is actually a lot of international precedent, and a lot of international precedent from what are called the old English common law systems, so places that were formerly colonies of Great Britain, places like India, Australia, and New Zealand, whose legal system and the basic legal reasoning is very similar to ours. But in New Zealand, the courts have recognized rights for major ecosystems. In a high court in India recognized rights for the Ganges River. And then in several countries in South America, Ecuador has written the rights of nature into their constitution, actually. So rivers have constitutional rights in Ecuador, and Colombia is pursuing similar rights of nature language in their own structural language. So courts have before looked to international bodies of law for precedent, and we're hoping that they'll do that in our case.
Well, let's talk about the river itself, because as you're talking to us this morning, Will Falk, you are in Moab, Utah, and the economy of that town really depends in many ways on the river, certainly for recreation. Rafting is absolutely huge there. Yet just upstream, there are several dams and several diversions off the river. What have you been finding as you're floating down the river? What are some of the issues that really highlight to you the need to have the Colorado River protected as an entity?
Well, the first thing is we keep thinking that we're going to see the Colorado River, and what we end up finding is a lot of industrial projects where the river is supposed to be. So we went right to the headwaters at La Poudre Pass north of Rocky Mountain National Park, and we thought we would see streams or some small thing that indicated that the Colorado River started up there. But what we found was the Grand Ditch, which was dug in the late 1880s to carry water across the Continental Divide over to the Front Range to get water to growing cities all the way back in the late 1880s. So again, we thought we were going to go see a wild place, but what we actually saw was a long industrial project. From Rocky Mountain National Park, we went down to Grand Lake, Colorado's largest natural body of water, and we learned that from Grand Lake, water is being pumped through a 13-mile tunnel that runs underneath the mountains in Rocky Mountain National Park, and again delivers water to the Front Range. So some of these iconic places that you're expecting or hoping to find a wild natural river, you're actually finding industrialized projects, and you're actually finding manipulations, large-scale manipulations of the river. So that has really been the theme of this whole trip, is this juxtaposition of the popular conception of the Colorado River as this wild being that's carved the Grand Canyon, that's carved through the Red Rock Deserts in southern Utah. But that wild being, by and large, doesn't actually exist. It is so exploited and so drawn down that in reality, the Colorado River is a series of man-made, human-made diversions and dams and ditches.
We're speaking this morning on KGNU with Will Falk, who is an attorney, who's a writer, and currently he's rafting down the Colorado River. He's joining us from Moab, Utah this morning. And Will is part of this group of folks. He's one of five next friends to the Colorado River. That's a legal term. They are suing the state of Colorado on behalf of the Colorado River. It's a landmark lawsuit that was filed in Denver court in September. And it all hinges on this new concept, well, new in the US, of the rights of nature, the legal rights of nature to exist and to flourish. Well, what's the current legal status of this? Because I believe you're back in court for a hearing in next Tuesday, November 14th. What's happening?
Yeah, so the official title of the hearing is a status conference. We're not entirely sure what the judge is going to do at this status conference. A status conference is usually scheduled for the judge to hear from both sides kind of how they envision the trajectory of the case going forward. The state of Colorado has filed a motion to dismiss the lawsuit, which is very standard in cases like these. And so the judge may want to hear arguments from the state on why the case should be dismissed and our arguments why they shouldn't, or she just might be interested in seeing what sort of timelines we each need to continue to build our case. So we're not really sure what's going to happen on the 14th, but we're really encouraging people who are interested to come to the courthouse in Denver on the 14th to support what we're doing and to show the judge and to show the legal system that the rights of nature are an idea whose time has really come.
Well, following that hearing, there will be a gathering at the Mercury Cafe on California Street in Denver around, it will centre on a discussion on the rights of nature, and that's following the hearing that's happening next Tuesday. We're speaking with Will Falk, who is one of the five next friends in this Colorado River versus the State of Colorado lawsuit. They're suing on behalf of the river as a natural entity, and it hinges on the rights of nature. If you have a question or a comment, you can call us now at 303-442-4242. And Will, all of this is happening while just last night, our elections in Longmont, one of the measures that voters approved was ballot issue 2J, which was a bonding issue, but it sought voters' authorization for Longmont to issue bonds for a water construction project, the Windy Gap Firming Project, and that is part of ongoing efforts to divert ever more water really close to the headwaters of the Colorado River on the western slope here to the Front Range. The state demographer projects that millions more people are headed to the Front Range of Colorado, moving here over the next few years. And at the center of all of this is, how can we provide resources for all of this, particularly when we're in a state that really does not have adequate water resources for all of the interests that need it, whether it's industry, whether it's agriculture, and whether it's the growing urban areas. So that is the current situation right now. Where is this going in terms of our water allocation when we are in an arid area, but we're seeing ever more people moving here that need water?
Yeah, well, the first thing to recognize is that the Colorado River's water, it's kind of a misconception to think that residential and municipal humans are using most of the river water. So it's actually close to 80%. I think the number is 78%. 80% of the Colorado River's water is used by corporations, especially for industrial agriculture. So there's somewhat less than 20% of that water is actually used by you and I for drinking water, for showers, for our own homes. So when we're thinking about how the Colorado River is being overdrawn and what those resources, what those, I guess, so-called resources are being divvied up for, we have to understand who is actually using the water. But then, yeah, to go deeper into this, I think that we need to recognize ecological reality and recognize that as human population goes up, there's going to be conflicts between the natural world, between physical reality and the natural world's ability to support human population. So, yeah, if the Colorado River is granted a right to exist, it might also come with a right to push back against human population. And I think that it should be clear by now that human population is one of the major problems affecting the environment right now. So while the rights of nature tries to address that reality on one hand, I think that we also need to address human population on another hand.
And I suppose that goes with human population is development and whether or not it is possible to have population growth and population development that could happen in a way that's maybe more in harmony with the natural environment. Do you think it is possible, or is this a zero sum? It's either winners or losers in this case. Is there a way that we could move forward together with nature having their own rights, but also acknowledging that we are in this situation where we're seeing massive human population growth and urban development?
Well, I think that ecologists know the populationists know now that the total population of humans on the Earth has gotten so large that we're actually drawing down the Earth's carrying capacity. So the longer that human populations remain this high, not only are we stressing the Earth's capacity to sustain these human populations, but we're also probably permanently reducing the Earth's carrying capacity for future generations. So I don't know about a zero sum, but I do think it's becoming imperative that human population starts to, if we keep growing, we are going to push ourselves into a collapse. And in the first place we're going to see that collapse is in the use of water. And with water being one of the very basic sources of life, we really need to start protecting that water as this is happening.
Colorado recently adopted or released its first ever statewide water plan. And as part of that, one of the areas that was identified for further exploration is ATMs, which is Alternative Transfer Methods, a temporary leasing program from agriculture to municipalities. Now, you did identify industrial agriculture as one of the biggest users of water. I think, the estimations go from 80% upwards of the water use in the state of Colorado really going to ag. So do you see some of these methods that have been identified as ways that we could try to mitigate some of these water resource problems we're having?
No, I think we need fundamental and institutional changes about how we actually conceive of the river. So the lawsuit, rights of nature, are aimed at this idea that a river or any ecosystem within the natural world can only be defined as a resource for humans to use and consume. So what we really need to change on a cultural level is the way humans see beings, entities like rivers. I don't think that that the current more technology, more plans that do not take a look at this very radical definition that humans use of the river will be effective at adequately protecting the river.
We're speaking with Will Folk this morning here on KGNU. He's an attorney. He's a writer. He's just recently written about this Colorado River lawsuit against the state of Colorado. It's online at sandiegofreepress.org, and we'll link to that at kgnu.org. But Will is also one of the five next friends in that lawsuit on behalf of the Colorado River against the state of Colorado. They're going to be back in court in Denver next Tuesday, November 14th, and that's at noon and after, or excuse me, that's at 10 a.m. After that hearing, there's going to be a gathering at the Mercury Cafe on California Street in Denver, and a further discussion about rights of nature litigation and what rights of nature and creative resistance can mean. At the heart of this, we did talk about that legal issue and the legal framework around rights of nature. But really, it seems that our own current legal system looks at natural resources as property, in which case we can do with it what we like. I mean, what is the connection between the two? If our current legal framework gives us, I suppose, dominion over nature, and so much then of the attitude towards nature is around how do we extract the maximum economic benefit for it, how can we align the two?
Well, we align the two by enacting things like the rights of nature. So as I was saying before, the rights of nature institutionalizes the subjective worth of a natural ecosystem like the Colorado River. I think when we're all looking at ourselves, or we're all thinking about why human beings have rights, why individual citizens have rights, we understand that those rights are based off of each of our own subjective value. We all have value as beings with life. And we're asking that same idea extend to a river. And again, I think we can all agree that the Colorado River does more for life in the arid American Southwest than any individual human does. And to stand in front of the Colorado River and to see those rivers or to see those waters moving down the river is to recognize that you're in the presence of a being that is so much greater than any one human or even many communities of humans. So we can reconcile this idea that that nature is property by actually giving nature the tools to realize its own subjective value through things like the rights of nature.
We just have 5 minutes left this morning with Will Folk, one of the five folks who are next friends in the Colorado River versus the state of Colorado lawsuit. Will is joining us this morning from Moab, Utah. He's been on the river for the past few days, really getting a firsthand look at the impacts of all of the diversions. Now, extracting water from the river is just one element of the crisis that the river has. There's also a lot of pollution as well. Talk a little bit about some of the other challenges facing the Colorado River.
Yeah, pollution is definitely one of them. I think another one, or perhaps even more urgent than pollution at this point, is climate change. The Colorado River depends on snowpack for most of its annual regeneration, and climate change, as probably all of your listeners are aware, is reducing snowpack across the West. And it's also been we've really in our travels the last few weeks we've been really surprised, or maybe not surprised, but it's really been driven home for us. We're driving through the Colorado River Basin to different places, and we're seeing coal plants, and we're seeing fracking wells, and we're seeing diversions of water for those fracking wells. And so it's really interesting to see in the reflection of the Colorado River a big smokestack from a coal plant. And it's just it's just you're seeing the destruction of a climate that the Colorado River needs to continue to have water. So with a major ecosystem like the Colorado River that depends on worldwide ecological processes, so many of the most serious environmental issues confronting us today are also threatening the Colorado River.
Well, there will be a hearing in the case of the Colorado River versus the state of Colorado in a Denver court. That's next Tuesday, November 14th. It's at 10 a.m. and it'll be followed by a gathering at noon at the Mercury Cafe, where there'll be further discussion about the rights of nature. We're going to link to Will Folk's article in the San Diego Free Press on the rights of the Colorado River, and particularly this lawsuit that'll be at kgnu.org. But in the meantime, we just have 1 minute left and we do have a last minute caller we'll try to squeeze in. We're going to welcome Rod from Longmont calling into KGNU. You're live on the air. Just a brief comment this morning.
Sure, babe. How's it going? Well, the one thing with the agricultural use is what we got to look at is the extractive industrial agriculture system. If we build healthy soil with lots of biology in it, it retains water, so we're not over-watering just like they do in Boulder County open space ag land. They over-irrigate. And if we look at like ways to conserve and build healthy soil, we wouldn't be using as much for agricultural use.
Thank you for that comment, Rod. And I'll direct listeners to news.kgnu.org or h2oradio.org. Last week, we aired their feature on how particularly young farmers in Colorado are looking at soil health as a way to increase decrease their water use and the role that soil health plays in all of these conversations. And all of our coverage of the Colorado River lawsuit and the Colorado River in general is online at news.kgnu.org. But in the meantime, I'd like to thank our guest, Will Folk. He's an attorney. He's a writer. His latest article on why the Colorado River needs to sue for rights, it's at online at sandiegofreepress.org, and he's one of the five next friends in this lawsuit, the Colorado River versus the state of Colorado. Once again, they're going to be back in court next Tuesday in Denver. That's at 10 a.m. and then that'll be followed by a gathering at the Mercury Cafe at noon. Will Folk, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
It's 9:30. You're listening to Community Radio KGNU. The next round of results in the local elections are expected to be released later this morning, so we'll bring you updates as soon as we have them. You can find the latest results that are available online at kgnu.org. Thanks so much for listening to the morning news today. I'm Maeve Conran. Stay tuned. Ginger is in for the Morning Sound Alternative.
Thank you. starts to fade. Anger just can't continue with that old masquerade. Remember the power that comes from above. When push comes to shove,
felt absurd, but you light the roots of my soul. I tell myself not to lose control. I'll take it slow, but it's hard to do when you're a lion like me and a lion like you. You got the hands that I want to hold. You light the room to the house of my soul. God damn. Break that rule. Guess I'm a fool. Should've known better, but there's